Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. Well, how do you define the American dream? For years, convention held that success was embodied in the suburban home on a tree-lined street with a white picket fence, maybe a few kids and a pet playing in the yard. But our next guest says that cliche is no more. The financial crisis hit American suburbs particularly hard and, in fact, may have exacerbated trends that were already showing a move away from the burbs. In the future, they may be even rendered unnecessary. Lee Gallagher is the assistant managing editor of Fortune magazine, and she is here to talk about her first book. It's called The End of the Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving. Lee, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks so much for having me.
I appreciate your being in the studio, and we're going to invite our listeners to call in. We have our phones open. If you've made a conscious decision to forego the suburban lifestyle and raise your family in the city, give us a call, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You can comment on our webpage about your suburban childhood. Go to WNYC.org, 433-9692. Is the number. You can click on Brian Lehrer's show on the webpage, or if you think the suburbs get a bad rap. If you left the city for the suburbs, perhaps with a hint of dread, but found yourself pleasantly surprised with your new lifestyle and your decision, we want to hear from you too. 212-433-WNYC. So your book is entitled The End of the Suburbs. That's a categorical title for sure. Is it really the end?
It's the end of the suburbs as we know them. I mean, there are a number of forces that have been at work for quite some time that were sort of exacerbated by the financial crisis. But the suburbs in the U.S. sort of started out as one thing, and then they morphed into something different. And that is, they started out, we think of the suburbs as the 1950s and 60s. And even for people who grew up in the 70s, you know, you think of the sort of Wonder Years era, a great house and a yard and kids playing in the street until supper's ready. And they sort of morphed over the years to sort of, you know, if you think of Wonder Years as one end of the spectrum, they morphed into sort of Weeds, the show on Showtime, where, you know, the opening credits are a spoof of the fact that everyone is sort of, they all
little
look
boxes,
just the same.
Tiny
exactly.
Houses, yeah.
Exactly. So, and, you know, a lot of people in this country actually live that way. And that is the more sort of
the Weeds way.
The Weeds way, the more sort of Stepford subdivision supersized way. I mean, the whole suburban experiment was sort of put on steroids to the point where for many people, they're no longer fulfilling the promise that people thought they were getting.
And you write that this wasn't just a spontaneous thing, that it was largely encouraged by the government through its policies. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. Well, I mean, the suburbs as we know them really exist thanks to generous federal policies going back even to right after the Great Depression, started with the creation of the FHA, which was at the time created to jumpstart lending and jumpstart the economy through the housing sector.
So even the original suburbs, the good suburbs?
Yeah, even the good suburbs. Yeah, I mean, until then, very few Americans actually owned a home, and that made it possible for many more Americans to own a home. But then the real change happened after World War II, when we had all these returning GIs and no place to put them. I mean, it's funny to think about now, but we actually had a housing shortage, you know, and in our last housing crisis, we had the exact opposite, of course. But so the GI Bill, which gave zero down loans to millions of returning GIs, and combined with the Federal Highway Act, which put in place the funding for 41,000 miles of highway. So it was these federal policies. It was also at the time what the American people wanted. I mean, there was this incredible fascination with the automobile, with the on the home building side, with mass production. The fact that these homes could be built on assembly lines was very new. And so this model just sort of exploded. And, you know, subdivisions were really cut and pasted all across the landscape. And then that expansion pattern just continued. And slowly that gave way to sort of suburban sprawl, which is the modern formula of strip mall, you know, shopping mall, Ruby Tuesdays, connected by miles of arterial highway.
Right, which you describe as sort of a thoughtless expansion. In fact, you come down very hard on certain suburban areas like California's Inland Empire. I was just there, by the way. And developments in Iowa that bill themselves as the suburbs of Chicago. But then, as you've indicated even here, there are some, I don't want to say you're fond of them, but the Northeast suburbs do fairly well in your book. Say a little bit more about, I guess, the Wonderland years, the Northeast suburbs. What about them? What's the differentiation? What works in one kind of suburb and what is missing in the others?
Sure. It basically comes down to age. Suburbs that were built before World War II were built on a different kind of DNA. They have different bones, a different blueprint. And after the war, we blew that model apart with what's called single-use zoning, which is really, I have a planner, Andreas Duani, quoted in my book as describing this as basically turning it into an unmade omelet. So what that means is basically it used to be that the suburbs were created as pedestrian villages when the only way to get there was by train or streetcar. They sprouted around the point of transportation in a very logical way that was focused around the needs that humans had. You had to be able to walk to the store and they were all condensed together. And then once the car entered the picture, we kind of came into this model where the stores are located in one place, the shopping malls are in another place, the houses are in another place, and you use your car to get from all these points, from A to B to C to D. So
I really appreciated your point about the trains versus the automobile. I really had never visualized it that way, but it makes complete sense.
Yeah, and it's not just it's not just the Northeast. There are great old suburbs in Ohio, in California. They're really all over the country. But the black and white determinant is really age. It's and studies. I have a couple studies in my book that link age of community to actually levels of happiness and shows greater levels of happiness and overall satisfaction with one's community based on when it was built. And I even have a study quoted in the book about linking that the age with actually health and weight, because there's a real health angle here in that you tend to walk more in these older communities. So one study from the University of Utah that I quote in the book actually links, says people weigh less in communities that are that were built earlier.
We should all move to Rome or Cairo. All right. Let's take Emily.
Hello. Good morning.
Hello. You're in Briarcliff, I see.
Yes, Briarcliff, sort of Briarcliff on the edge of Ossining. We're sort of in Briarcliff and Ossining at the same time because the school system is the Ossining schools.
So what is your suburban story?
Well, I was raised in the suburbs in a sort of outside of White Plains, and you had really needed a car to get just about anywhere. It was never the American dream for me growing up, for various reasons, not only because it was a suburb, and then I moved upstate to a small community in the Catskills for a bunch of years, and then because of my husband's work, we moved back to the suburbs, first to Putnam County, which for I think two or three census counts was the fastest-growing county in New York State, and the kind of development they did there was just, in my view, disgraceful because, it was just like one. It was the new model of suburban development.
So you appreciate Lee Gallagher's point about the old suburb versus the new suburb.
Well, actually, so yes, because the old suburbs grew up like along the Harlem line, along the Hudson line, along the train line, rail lines, and at that time the dads went into the city to commute generally. And most moms stayed home. But my dad commuted along the Harlem line, but my mother had to drive him to the station. It was a mile, so he could have walked it, but, he was in a hurry to get to the train, so she drove him to the train. It wasn't just a couple of blocks. And I ended up living back in the suburbs, but a number of years ago, my husband and I and a group of people tried to start a co-housing community within an hour's commute of Grand Central. We really tried hard. I'm going to try again to get it. We almost got there.
Emily, that will be its own segment.
That will be its own segment. I hope you bring that segment in. I hope I'll have something positive to say.
Thank you, Emily, so much for your call.
Thank you.
Brought up so many issues. I mean, even putting the co-housing aside, the driving versus the train, the changing nature of the suburbs, all things that you talk about in your book. And so I want to talk a little bit about demographic changes, societal trends, and how they're changing the makeup of the suburbs. And let's start with this love affair with the car.
Sure.
The car played such a central role in the American lifestyle and obviously in the suburbs. Do you think it's falling out of favor? Why do you think it's falling out of favor? Our next segment is going to be about what we're calling the end of the car. This is our end of hour. So talk about that and what you perceive to be the changing nature of suburbs.
Sure. Well, we are driving less annually in terms of vehicle miles traveled. That's going down, and that is linked a little bit to the recession. But there's also the interesting thing about the car that I go into a lot of detail in about the book is what is millennials' relationship to driving, and that's really changing. They're getting their driver's license in far fewer numbers, and I have one example in the book of a someone I know whose daughter turned 16, and he said, all right, well, come on, you want to go get your driver's license? And she looked at him, and she said, maybe next year. And he was like, maybe next year? I mean, what? That's just foreign. So that's and the data supports that, and that's a that's just a really major shift. You know,
so
they're more interested in their devices.
Right. If you're a developer in Las Vegas or Atlanta or someplace where you need to drive, 22% of millennials saying, I never need to get a license and I never will, that's got to be a concern.
That's a problem for the future. They really want walkable communities. The other issue, you mentioned demographic changes, is that with the birth rate falling in this country, the households that are married couples with children, which were the building blocks of suburbia, are rapidly becoming the minority to the point where already, statistically speaking, in the book I make this point, there are more baby boomers and senior citizens in the suburbs today than families with young children. And that's a pretty monumental shift. And so what you have is and are going to continue to have are people aging in the suburbs, which is not so easy, and it's something a lot of communities are trying to deal with now.
So you mean not so easy because it's harder to get around, et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. And it's harder to age in your home when you have a big home or suburban home. So there's all these groups that will come in and help older people, you know, retrofit their homes with bars in the bathroom and things like that, rather than pulling up roots and moving into a retirement community. But the other issue is that the taxpayer base is going to change. I mean, you have a lot of nonprofits here in the Westchester suburbs, actually. I found in the book I mentioned a few groups in Rye. There's a group called Staying Put in Rye, and it's Environs, and it's called Spry. And this is a group that's it's really its mandate is to help older people with getting around, getting to medical appointments, making sure that services are available. And similar groups exist in Bronxville and Greenwich and really all over the place. I mean, this is going to be a driving force driving the conversation in America's suburbs going forward. And it's also going to have an impact on the kind of housing stock we have and the demand going forward for the kind of housing stock we're going to need.
Let's take one more call if we could. And I think I would go to Cheryl, who looks as though she moved from the suburbs. Cheryl, have I got that right?
Yes.
Cheryl, go ahead. You're on WMYC.
Hi.
Tell us your suburban story.
Well, when we first got married, we lived in the city, and I loved it. It was so fabulous. And when I was pregnant with my second child, everybody said, oh, my God, you can't bring up kids in the city. You've got to move to the suburbs. Everybody thought that. You have to have a backyard. So we moved to the suburbs, and I was so lonely. It was I missed the city so much, but I adjusted and made friends. But my older son was not an athlete. And let me tell you, if you are not an athlete, if your children are not athletic in the suburbs, that's really what they do on the weekends. It's very centered around soccer and baseball and all kinds of sports. And it just didn't work for us. And we finally put the kids into private school in Riverdale and then eventually moved back to the city, where both of them found, one being athletic and the other not, found their place in the world. And we never looked back.
Well, Cheryl, thank you so much. And I guess one of the suggestions of Lee's book is that your choice may be a trend. Let me ask you, Lee, before we go, there are two questions I want to ask you, but this one I must ask, and that is about the encroachment, perhaps, of poverty into the suburbs. You know, the suburbs used to be enclaves of the wealthy. And it does seem that poverty is popping up in the suburbs. Is that right?
It is. This is one of the most striking trends of the last decade. And the Brookings Institution has done a lot of work on this, which I mentioned in the book. But for the first time, there are more poor people are living in the suburbs than in cities, in big cities in this country. And that's dramatic. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that a lot of the job opportunities kind of went out to the suburbs, especially if you think about home building, restaurant work. You know, so a lot of people kind of, instead of going to cities and then going to suburbs, went right to the suburbs for those jobs. But the other thing that happened is that as the suburbs grew and grew and grew, you know, they started out being these sort of single class, homogenous enclaves that were safe and pretty and you know, for the upper middle class, really. That's how they started out. And as they grew and grew and grew, they came to reflect more of America itself. So I have a great quote in the book about how they just came to mirror the country in general. And so this person, demographer for the Brookings Institution, actually said, if it's part of America, it's part of the suburbs. So now everything we have in the cities, we have in the suburbs, and sometimes more. Crime as well as poverty is both rising in the suburbs now and falling in cities. And that's one of a number of totally shocking reversals I found that I mentioned in the book.
So is this end of the suburbs a good thing, a bad thing, or just a thing?
You know, it's really a good thing because city life isn't for everyone. And my argument is not that every single person is going to come and run and live in a skyscraper in Manhattan. That's not realistic. But what is happening is there's this tremendous shift. Every home builder is working on this. Every developer is working on this. People want more walkable communities. They want to live closer to the things they need to do. I have a quote in the book that says, location, location, location has turned into access, access, access. People want to be closer to things. They want to have a better lifestyle. And this really is better for everybody. It means healthier lives, happier lives. You know, people want out of their cars and they want out of the sort of isolationist lifestyle that so many of our modern suburbs came to deliver. So it is actually an optimistic vision.
I think so, too. And I thank you so much. It is also a wonderful book, The End of the Suburbs. Lee Gallagher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up next, my buddy Alex Goldmark will be here to talk about the end of driving. I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer.